Okay, say when. Wild Grape Wine continued. Mr. Greenhaw's Love Poem, or Passion Among the Espers. Mr. Greenhaw stands behind the counter, a gray, smallish, soberish, middleish man, measures out 5 pounds of potatoes. A girl with good breasts and a figure watches Mr. Greenhaw measure 10 years ago in Vancouver. Another man watches the girl, watching the grocer, thinking, goodness me, she'd be nice, it'd be nice to sail away with you into the land of Moo. Down on 2nd Avenue, East Indian music tightens wire drawstrings on Mr. Greenhaw, while a bright dust settles on the potatoes. Beyond here is water, with light laid on it, like the wrappers of countless candy bars blowing across a concrete parade ground. And there's a war going on somewhere, too, and certainly harbors beyond this one. The girl says, a package of players also, please. Mr. Greenhaw doesn't answer, being occupied with watching the girl, watching him. He is since deceased. Other harbors where other things happen, though everything seems one continuous thing that never stops happening. The harbor cook found at Nootka, for instance, and the Indian chief, Maquina, thinking Cook's ship was an enchanted salmon. I better do that again. The harbor cook found at Nootka, for instance, and the Indian chief, Maquina, thinking Cook's ship was an enchanted salmon, and getting jipped to 300 skins by the captain. And suddenly it's 10 years later, but nobody knows the difference, for the clocks all tell the same time. I don't quite know how we got here, but this is a kitchen, and I am standing watching a girl scrub dust from potatoes, which I suppose must go somewhere else. Settles on teacups, sifts into medical records and tombs and things. She is well aware I wanted to, watching Mr. Greenhaw, watching you, once or twice at least since 10 years ago. On some gossamer human wavelength, the potatoes touch each other and whisper delicate things outside the cul-de-sac of speech. The air in the room is a quivering silence of boiling potatoes. And we are steaming deep inside ourselves beyond the land of Moo, having achieved a kind of breakthrough, and through insights granted conditionally, I know all this will not be so. Me being a grayish, drunkish, largest, anguished man, with unsung children and tone-deaf wife. Dust leaves the 10-year-old boiling spuds and settles heavy on furniture. No music, the moment lengthens. This is no harbor. And even Nootka, or Grey Vancouver. And yet I know it's here, the one important thing among so many that always eludes you, the woman who dissolves in mist if you come too near, and was never there, or the smile and nod of approval from some admired personal god, or the final answer to all things, or none of these. Nothing is said or can be said. Music dies. And everyone gets gypped sooner or later by death or disease or what's inside them. Because the world is that sort of place, i.e., it has harbors and candy bars and wire music, though hardly any Indian chiefs these days, and girls cooking spuds and 10-year-old dust and things. It has toy boats sailing off at a certain angle of vision through kitchen and living room, where trade winds snore around the studio couch, and enchanted salmon die in dirty dishwater. Dishes break in the sink without being touched. Potatoes are almost cooked now, and everyone concerned is getting quite hungry for the 10,000th time. I want dinner, in a manner of speaking. But tendrils beyond speech touch and say to the Indian babe I knew at Nootka or somewhere, I say, dear Miss Yu, those white peeled potatoes look like ping pong balls with all their bouncing done. Which is to say, my dear, they're drained of all but calories, or maybe they're like naked paper envelopes attached by stiff wire clips. And airmail, it says, in the wild joined pubic hair. Airmail, it says, and youth drains swiftly out of me, and the dust of the sea and the dust of the bouncing ping-pong balls are settled somewhere else. Lady, ma'am, that is, should we wash the dishes? Mr. Greenhaw, perhaps, is dead. Death of a young poet. A boy whose poems remain still part of his personal being, even when written and dropped into a public mailbox. When some faceless man rejected them, I suppose it was as if pins were stuck in a voodoo doll on the other side of a continent. But mediocrity must be faced, and furies are ridiculous editors with snuffling noses and bent backward honesty, he knew, though great thoughts were beyond him in desolate back alleys of a city, and thundering caesuras begin in the tick of ended pulse, his life's income taxed and non-refundable. I grow old in the city rain, among garbage cans and broken bottles, and smell of a cat's after birth, dog shit in gutters, lost somewhere in my own decaying body. Only the written extensions of myself are alive somewhere else, and I move softly as a grave robber, bending no blade of grass beneath the sidewalk, touching no live thing, and walking forever in that curious dead light the sun gives after it has gone down. My face is a shining grave marker in the black rain among the tombs of my friends. He was 27. He remained 27 a long time. Stanley House for Louis Dudek. Stanley House, by the way, was the place where there were a gathering of poets at the expense of Canada Council. On our way to Gaspé, not long after E.J. Pratt died, Narowski driving the car, Dudek with beret, mouth organ, and horn-rimmed glasses, like a giant mosquito in the front seat, composing a dirge for Pratt. When we stopped at service stations, attendants looked at me peculiarly. Dudek had told them I was the idiot son of a millionaire who paid him to be my nursemaid. I kept looking for female kidnappers. At the house on Bay Chaleur, poets gathered together while the wood fire burned. And something about these middle-aged men, who bossed no construction projects nor captained any industry, did none of the world's hard work, but merely sang middle-aged songs. A carelessness to the greeting that gave it a kind of grace, like seeing a butterfly with suspenders. What happened? Some things you notice, like knotted string, but what happened in between what happened, I didn't notice. And what happened after is beyond noticing at all. Like seeing in the middle of lovemaking that the mended spot in the sheet looks like a white carnation. The woman and the flower bloom alone now. Going was just as casual, goodbye and one for the road. Next day, when Don looked in the windows, no one was there, or hardly anyone. In Bay Chaleur, at ebb tide, herons staked out across the shallows in their motionless fishing ritual. But no one looking at them either. The middle-aged butterfly is gone. Living in Toronto. This is about the time when we lived on Sackville Street. It's a maze you see into, but don't comprehend. In the juncture of Riverdale Zoo and Toronto Crematorium, it puzzled Darwin. Living in the fortunate slums near Parliament Street in Old Cabbage Town, among the drunks and Italian workmen, there was always a monster stench lurking near the shop for crippled civilians, watching from 19th century houses, choosing a victim from drunk and sober in rain or slush on Parliament Street. But I have escaped into the rural countryside, where dogs bark and cows moo, and I can't stand it any longer. I shall have to go back, expecting to be disappointed, knowing full well that poor beast from another century, with red, ravening jaws gaped open, fiery eyes doused by the fire department, must be lying dead somewhere on the streets of Toronto. And I have to see what they look like, the killers of that poor innocent beast who didn't know what he was getting into. Listeners, this is a revised poem from Poems for All the Annettes. I might have married her once, but being an overnight guest of hers changed my mind. A big man who looked like a truck driver, getting sober as you can get on beer. And he suddenly burst out with that. What happened? I said. Her old man was dying of something or other in a room downstairs, without drugs, and screamed most of the time. I could see the line of light under her door, and I kept wanting and then not wanting her, between yells. I'd hear the wind blow, the woodwork creak, and listen some more and think of the girl. Then he'd scream. The waiter came by with beer. Here, I said, and paid him, and grinned in the familiar, friendly roar of the jam-full tavern, and talk boomed in my ears. Go on, I said. After midnight, me lying and listening, hearing people asleep and some not asleep, the sounds an old house makes to itself for company, the nails and boards and bricks holding together such a long time and knowing so many things about people. Then he'd scream, and I'd say to myself, go on and die, go on and die. They must have had the windows wide open, for the sound came in from outside, too. I'd hear the crickets, and he'd scream. Finally, I heard the girl scramble out of bed. She came rushing into my room in a nightgown and dragged me downstairs and outside, holding my hand so hard her nails dug in, holding my hand and running like hell into the fields, into the fields. Oh, it was good, I thought. It was fine, the silence, and she wanting me and I. But I looked, and it wasn't wanting in her eyes, not wanting at all in her gray eyes, but waiting. My God, what was she waiting for in that wheat field? What did she want to happen, or make me do, or say, or be there in the moonlight? Well, anyway, defiantly, I wouldn't. Reassurance seemed in order when I looked at the big, sweating red face and said, nothing happened. You didn't make love. The old man didn't die. You went away unchanged. He looked at me, and the room grew silent, as if everyone had been listening to his story. At closing time around the upside-down tables, everyone listened still. Everyone listened. This, too, is a revised poem from the Annettes. A Quarrel. Lying side by side, naked in darkness, bodies stiff with anger, tempered thoughts clashing like swords in the room's corners, a limited sort of agony that doesn't kill you, but could. The moon sinks teeth in bedroom, chews at the curtain rod, lifting ocean tides of rage, drags both one-time lovers into its twitching pattern, self-conscious and mere embryum. Merimbrium, my darling, running with great 30-foot strides in the apogee and perigee of love, throwing handfuls of pumice and sliding down shale hills in a dream slalom to Lacus Mortis and Lacus Somniorum, where youth is a twinkle in the eye of the absolute, and pride an absolute necessity for virgins. Self-conscious and merimbrium, mad as hell in a bedroom in Ameliasburg Township, even as in the councils of the great, my darling, and the consultations of the kings of earth, a small quarrel like ours can't be solved. And while that white body protrudes over on my side of the bed, pride is damn difficult. After the miscarriage, white on white sheets, a girl's smile is a collection of shadows, arranged in some way it resembles sadness. No doubt this arrangement of words will make you smile, whether they correspond to reality or not. And smiling so easily, you make sadness a sort of rationed luxury none of your friends can afford. My dear, now one of your monthly children, the May one, veers to a different calendar, where nothing is expected of you. A lover is being born. St. Francis in Ameliasburg. Returning to the tar paper shack, which is home sweet home for me, among rambler roses and old tin cans, on a cold May afternoon, I lit the oil stove, hauled in some groceries, went out to look around, bundling up on account of the glaciers. Two robins' nests behind the house, one on the electric box, the other right on the stovepipe, where smoke comes out, each with four blue eggs and hopeful grins etched in the shells. Turned down the stove damn quick, and happily began to imagine myself as Surrogate Robin, a super special big mama, social worker among the birds, who would scream to my rescue when my wife attacks me next time, or perhaps locate for me the lost gold feather from the wing of Icarus. That oil stove warming the nest by about 15 degrees, aiding incubation, I figured, which consoled me for the lack of whiskey in the house that night. Anyhow, the hydro man came to give me the rural loyalty oath. Next day, I noticed both nests were knocked to the ground, blue eggs smashed and yolks torn. He must have thought they were a fire hazard, and I thought, son of a bitch, I'll never get to be a mother robin. On a park bench, at some distance, a mother with her two children, playing in the shrubbery. I am surprised she sits still, for I feel her nerves quiver inside mine, an almost secret hysteria, holding her stiff as a flower stalk. I've just made a 2-to-1 bet with myself. That woman will run wildly away from here in exactly 1 second, leaving arms and pieces of her body strewn on the blacktop. For unknown reasons. But I lose. She doesn't. Not to Welsh on a bet, I throw away the price of 2 beers on the grass, hoping the coins mean more to someone than a gesture. Then the small boy catches the girl, cloaked with her fist, and makes her cry. The mother calls her children, bends over them, lips moving, dropping round little anchors of silence in their ears. And 2 different answers to the same sadness. I can't hear what she's saying. Bum, Horace Ouster. The fat old man in the park started to cough, a sound like laughter, paroxysm and seizure, with all his brain, belly, and guts rolled into a gigantic ho, ho, ho at death. It scared off the pigeons. And melted an iron frost from the ground. Recovering with a red face, he winked at me. I was a soft touch when he hit me up for 2 bits to help buy a bottle. Rolled into a gigantic ho, ho, ho at death. Hunting season. Men as executives, laborers, company presidents, priests, kings. In the hunting season, they wear red shirts, black boots, blow horns, pretending to be moose, with some success. Driving north on the Bancroft Road, 1 mile of blacktop ripped up, emergency repairs going on, thinking. Once, the road was something else. No one to say what it was. No need to be anything. Once, a track through the forest. A place where leaves fell, because leaves do fall, though no one watches. Once, for the first time, a name. A place on the earth. Then men hallooing, saying, boys, this is where the road should be, where you can buy a ticket to. Here, under the raw earth mask, nothing pretends. And every deer passing by in moonlight, on the vanished highway, is a dead Chevrolet strapped on its back, heading for the place the town was. Remains of an Indian village. This is considerably revised poem. Underfoot rotten boards, forest rubble, bones. Animals were here after the plague, after smallpox, to make another ending. For the tutelary gods of decay acknowledge aid from any quarter. Here the charging cotyledons of spring press green forefingers on femurs, vertebra, and delicate bell skulls of children. The moon's waylaid light does not shrink from bone relics and other beauties of nature. Death is certainly absent now. At least in the overwhelming sense that it once walked at night in the village and howled through the mouths of dogs. but everything fades and wavers into something else. The seasonal cycle and the planet's rhythm vary imperceptibly into the other. Spirits of the dead are vanished. Only great trees remain. And the birth certificate of cedars specifies no memory of a village. And I have seen myself fade from a woman's eyes while I was standing there. And the earth was aware of me no longer. But I come here as part of the process, in the pale morning light, thinking what has been thought by no one for years of their absence, in some way continuing them. And I observe the children's shadow running in this green light from a distant star into the near forest, wood violets and trilliums of 100 years ago blooming and vanishing, the villages of the brown people toppling and returning, what moves and lives, occupying the same space, what touches what touched them, owes them. Standing knee-deep in the joined earth of their weightless bones, in the archaeological sunlight, the trembling voltage of summer, in the sunken reservoirs of rain, standing waist-deep in the crisscross rivers of shadows, in the village of nightfall, the hunters silent, and women bending over dark fires, I hear their broken consonants. Baudouin. This is probably the one of the two or three poems I wrote about working in Montreal at a factory in Saint-Germain. Baudouin, a journeyman upholsterer. The magnetic hammer takes tacks from his mouth in one continuous rhythmic movement, his hands gliding over the shape of a chair, as if he were adjusting a queen's underwear, tugging and straightening the floral satin, describing the ideal shape of a perfect chair, with identical hand movements for every one, always the same, like a weird semaphore or ballet for workers. I suspect he does the same thing every night, in bed, tacking a new skin onto his wife's bones. Hortense, you look just beautiful, while morning loops the loop around the world. Baudouin, I tell him, there's nothing at all under your hands. You think there's a chair, but you're dead wrong. The immortal gods have condemned you to stand under a 100-watt bulb on the third planet from the sun, with a headache for $1.70 an hour, doing nothing at all forever but wave your hands. Baudouin stops with his mouth full of 8-ounce tacks and grins and says, "Pretty, you're nuts." And he's probably right. Love poem for my wife. Working. I suppose she sweats under the arms like I did. She works. Not 8 to 5, but longer. I left my job at the factory. She takes it home. Sits up till 5 a.m. An embryo teacher preparing lessons. And sleeps at the table like Farah's wine taster since B.C. something. I guess she aches, too. In the wrong places for a woman whose breasts and belly make no sense in a factory. I was a dead animal after 3 in the afternoon, though it doesn't matter now, and rides the ghost ride home on any streetcar, which finally skips the last stop and keeps going to the suburbs. With a moderate passion, she, reading over my shoulder, says, "It ain't like that, you real nasty. Speak soft, honey, I love you." I enunciate carefully, having had previous missile experience. And watch that grammar, too, for time's booby-prized passion has taken over my sweet, what I warn most about, namely, and to wit, globs and globs of love, speeding swift as a recessive gene, from wife to husband to children, from son to daughter and grandson, love, for the most needy applicant, whether newborn or senile, is drifting indiscriminate over the classroom, from teacher, dear teacher, to the children, dear children, heirs of all the ages. Triumphant love floats angelic over the little buggers. I guess a poem. Walking in spring through the soggy leftover world, which is all that remains of the last bright August. like burned toast and coffee dregs spilled on an old tablecloth. It's late afternoon. I'm a little bored, climbing over split rail fences, scraping mud from shoes, tired with a winter hangover. A 5-minute snowstorm swirls suddenly from leaden sky, dumps half an inch of itself, redecorates the world, and ends just as suddenly. I sit down on a stone to rest, feeling my head begin to empty of things. And the northern trees include me with faulty understanding, not like a man, but as mahogany or teakwood. The land around is still white when I open my eyes later, after a few minutes or half an hour, I've no way of knowing. There are small tracks approaching close to my feet, then turning away, a circle, as if I've been danced around. I bend down to examine the tracks, hoping to find a feather that chirps bird, or maybe a tuft of fur that growls beast, but nothing. The snow is melting. Already the tracks fade in warm spring evening. The freakish weather ended. But I think they watch me from trees and brush nearby as light lies from trees and brush nearby as light dies down. I'm all that's left in a melting clearing. Their eyes intersect my hand, rubbing bristly chin. My yawn trembles in their several eardrums. And I walk home through the night, invisible to them now, following damp furrows across someone's cornfield, holding in my head a small bright area that speaks man, along with a voice that says, "So what?" While the dead underfoot whisper, the land stirs to life, and nothing is impossible. Panhandlers in Camagüey. This is a relic of a trip to Cuba in 1964. Maybe the last panhandlers in all Cuba come here with the excuse of a guitar to sing songs for Canadian visitors in the lobby of the Grand Hotel, in a town where the legend of green-eyed girls makes it a magic place. There is something pure and innocent about being the last gypsy panhandlers, as if all the muscles connecting them with living a useful 8-to-5 life, being productive members of a socialist state, had been severed by a decadent capitalist surgeon. "Hey, Miguel, hey, Pedro, shake your hips and dance like hell for joy as long as you can, while Barbara from Vancouver smiles, and the labor's woman's stern face softens. The Toronto communist is indulgent, the law prof from Montreal is happy, because French joy de vivre is verified. And I am forever trapped in this sentimentality, but applaud like the rest, knowing our guides will soon interfere, instructing the performers to return their fee, making everyone uncertain about their own loyalties, to socialist state or free enterprise bums, or the yearning in them that doesn't fit anything. Barbara from Vancouver, she of the easy tears, palms $2 and slips it to them, and everybody is obliquely satisfied. All night I walked the streets of Camagüey, looking for green-eyed girls, wanting to give them money, but can't find any, and wake in the heat, feeling sad." On the Avenida Juarez, Mexico City. On the Avenida Juarez, Mexico City. The old Indian woman may be young, for she suckles a baby and sells lottery tickets with her free arm and hoarse voice sounding like a deaf tomcat. Her bare brown feet are splayed and flattened on the pavement. And the shoeshine boys do not accost her, or the smart American women glance her way in the concrete interval between fashionable shops. She has certainly been sacrificed to Quetzalcoatl, god of civilizations, whose lineal descendants are Imperial Oil Company and Coca-Cola, but her ritual death is unreasonably prolonged.